strategy. Today's training is based on the technical and regulatory guidance document, Integrated DNAPL Site Strategy, and we're going to introduce you to this guidance during today's training class, and we do hope that it becomes a resource that you can use after today's class. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to cover some introductory material in the next few slides and then turn the training over to our trainers from the ITRC Integrated DNAPL Site Strategy team. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and it's hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. A few housekeeping items to cover. Today's course is 2.25 hours. We are recording today's session. During today's class, the trainers control the slides. If you want to control your own slides, you can download the presentation. And that's on that CLUIN training page where we started today. We do look for your questions and feedback. Throughout today's training class, you're welcome to send in a question or a comment using the Q&A box in the lower right. At the question and answer breaks, you're welcome to unmute your phone to ask questions out loud. For those questions you want to ask out loud, we do ask that you hold those to the Q&A breaks. But you're welcome to send in questions and comments in that Q&A box throughout today's class. At the end of the class, we do look for everyone on the call to fill out the feedback form. The feedback is available from the last slide. It's also available in those related links. So it's the fourth item down. To access it during the class, you select feedback, and then you look down a bit. There's a button that says Browse To, and that's going to open that in a new window for you. One of the features that is available only through the feedback form is to create a certificate of participation for today's training class. So if you do need confirmation of your attendance today, a great way to do that is to fill out the feedback form, be sure to check at the box at the bottom, and then submit. So if you forget to check the box, just go back, check the box again. More information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website, www.itrcweb.org. Overall, ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators. It includes our federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. The full ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of this slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. We encourage you to use ITRC's presentations and documents for educational purposes, both in your work and if you need to deliver training to others. Please credit ITRC, review the ITRC usage policy, and let us know about your success. Use of ITRC materials for profit is not permitted. More information is available on the ITRC website, and I do encourage you to visit the website. I'll introduce our trainers for today's class. All trainers are members of the ITRC Integrated DNAPL Site Strategy team. That team was led by Najee Akhlatis of the Maine Department of Environmental Protection. Aaron Cohen is a project contract manager at the Florida Department of Environmental Protection in Tallahassee. He supervises and coordinates the cleanup of chlorinated solvent and hazardous waste sites with the Florida Dry Cleaning Solvent Cleanup Program, the state-funded Hazardous Waste Program, and Superfund. Ryan Wymore works for CDM Smith in Denver, Colorado. He specializes in innovative groundwater remediation technologies, particularly bioremediation, monitored natural attenuation, and chemical oxidation. Alex McDonald is a senior engineer in the technical support section of the cleanup unit at the Central Valley Regional Water Quality Control Board in California. He primarily works on the cleanup of the Aerojet site in Rancho Cordova and other nearby sites of the McCullen Air Force Base. Dr. Chuck Newell is Vice President of GSI Environmental, Inc. in Houston, Texas. His professional expertise includes site characterization, groundwater modeling, non-aqueous phase liquids, risk assessment, natural attenuation, bioremediation, software development, and long-term monitoring projects. Dr. Heather Ratanis is unable to join us, but thanks to Chuck for filling in on her section. Dr. Tamsin McBeth is the Vice President at CDM Smith in Helena, Montana. She specializes in the development, demonstration, and application of innovative, cost-effective technologies for contaminated groundwater. I'll now turn today's presentation over to Aaron Cohen at the Florida Department of Environmental Protection. Aaron? And Aaron, you may need
Sorry
to
about that, Juliana. I was talking and I was muted. I apologize to everybody listening. So let's go ahead and get started. We should all be on slide number 6. It says the problem at the top. During the development of previous ITRC DNAPL documents and discussions regarding this document amongst team members, it became apparent that there were many DNAPL sites that had no clear strategy to deal with them. At many sites, insufficient progress forward is being made. Large sums of money are continuing to be spent over long periods of time with little or no clear benefits to the environment, and little return on investment is being seen. For example, in Florida, we have a short list of sites where the state has spent over $1 million in cleanup, and we've not yet achieved an actual site closure. In the current climate of reduced budgets and limited funding, this really isn't a list that anyone wants their site to be on. The team determined that a process to develop a DNAPL site strategy was needed, which we believe will significantly improve the remedy process at many sites. Thus, the Integrated DNAPL Site Strategy, or IDSS, was created. Additionally, if you remove the DNAPL-specific information presented in today's training, many parts of the strategy are useful and applicable to a variety of sites requiring cleanup, not just DNAPL sites. Moving on to slide 7. During the team's discussions, we found 4 main challenges associated with DNAPL sites. First, in order to sufficiently clean up a site, you need to have knowledge of the site. It's critical to understand the site geology, the hydrogeology, source area, contaminant strength, and the location of DNAPL and other components of the contamination. Many times, there's not an adequate understanding of the site to allow for appropriate decisions to be made. Second, the DNAPL matrix is complex. DNAPL contamination may be found in free phase, dissolved phase, sorb phase, and vapor phase. Site complexity is compounded by the fact that contamination in these chemical phases may be present in or around a variety of geologic as well as man-made media, such as pipes, sewer lines, and beneath structures. Third, some remedial objectives that have been established are simply unrealistic. They may not have may not be achievable in a reasonable time frame, or there's no way to measure or quantify the objective. And fourth, a process for determining if and when a remedy has failed or is underperforming or needs to be switched is unclear or in many cases not in place. This causes sites to stall or become stuck with no path forward. Our IDSS document helps to improve the chances for achieving success at DNAPL sites despite all of these different challenges. Let's move on to slide 8. So the IDSS team and its predecessor, the DNAPL team, are like many other ITR teams in that they're composed of a very diverse cross-section of individuals representing many disciplines. Members are from state and federal agencies, universities, community stakeholders, and a large amount of industry professionals and practitioners. It's this mix of professionals with diverse expertise and experience, along with differing points of view, that has led to the development of this integrated site strategy tool. Let's move on to slide 9. So our solution for dealing with DNAPL sites is an integrated DNAPL site strategy, or IDSS. The IDSS is a form of comprehensive site management, and as such, it's a process. I repeat, it's a process by which you can develop your own site-specific strategy to address your site-specific issues. It's not a plug-and-chug or a one-size-fits-all document where you run down a checklist, select an appropriate box, and all your problems are solved. Rather, it's a process to allow you, the site manager, to address the unique set of nuances, issues, and site conditions that will drive the specific strategy for your site. The IDSS is ideally suited and used as early in the site evaluation and remediation process as possible. However, because the process is iterative, you can enter it at any time, and as a new site knowledge and information is obtained, the IDSS should be reviewed, it should be revised, reevaluated, and modified as needed to reflect this new understanding of the site. The IDSS is not for novice people or people who have never worked on a DNAPL site before. DNAPLs are complex, and you'll need to be familiar with DNAPL sites and their remediation to use this process and to get the most out of it for your site. One more thing I'd like to mention about the process is that there are components and elements that are applicable to many other types of sites. The novice can use the process to determine how to evaluate and assess the contamination at their non-Dean Apple site. So don't get turned off by the Dean Apple specific elements mentioned in today's training. Also, as we move through the training, references will be made to the IDSS document. So if you haven't already downloaded a copy of the IDSS tech reg from the ITRC website, I'd encourage you to do so. So moving on to slide 10. This figure shows a snapshot of figure, or this slide rather, shows a snapshot of figure 1-2 from the IDSS document. This is basically the process flow diagram for our document and the roadmap today's training is going to follow. We begin with the development of a conceptual site model, which is the most important step in the process. Without an accurate, complete conceptual site model, it will be very difficult at best to develop a remedy that will perform as you want it. Mr. Ryan Wymore from CDM Smith will cover this section in more detail. Next, we discuss remedial objectives and focus on applying the SMART criteria to objectives. Alex McDonald from the California Water Board will lead this discussion. From there, we move on to a discussion combining and optimizing remedial technologies, which will be led by Dr. Chuck Newell from GSI Environmental. And as Juliana mentioned, Chuck will also head up our discussion of monitoring strategies based upon site-specific cleanup objectives, the selected remedy and approach, and remedial performance goals. Lastly, but not at all least, Tamsin McBeth from CDM Smith will conclude the training by discussing remedy evaluation to determine how your remedy is performing, how you can improve an existing remedy, and what to do if your remedy is not working. She will also discuss how to incorporate this information into your conceptual site model and how to determine if you require additional data to make a decision. So, moving on to slide 11. What we want to teach you and what we want you to leave this training with are an understanding of the importance of the conceptual site model and how to develop one for your site, how to develop SMART objectives and how they provide a better way to measure site cleanup, how, when, where, and why you monitor technology performance, how to couple and transition between different remedial technologies, and which ones apply and how to combine them so they perform better, and lastly, how to determine if your remedial approach is not working and what you can do to improve upon it. So with that said, we should all be on slide 12, and I will turn the discussion over to Ryan Wymore, who will talk about the conceptual site model in more detail.
All right, thank you, Aaron. So again, we should all be on slide 12 for those who are navigating the slides on your own. The first step in IDSS that we're going to talk about here is the conceptual site model. And I know we've all heard about this and have developed them at our sites, but what we wanted to do for the IDSS process and the document overall was to really provide a good definition of what the components of a CSM are, specific to Dean Apple sites, but also in general for any kind of a complex site. So on this slide, we're just trying to capture the idea that a CSM is basically a summary of what you know about the site. We kind of are trying to follow the mantra that if you don't understand the problem, you're likely not going to be able to solve the problem. So the conceptual site model is an organized set of ideas about the site, the key elements of the site. You may involve detailed understanding of the vadose zone, the saturated zone. Maybe there's a surface water discharge at your site that needs to be evaluated. You need to consider receptors and the mechanisms for contaminants to get to those receptors. Are there risks? What's the relationship between the receptors and the subsurface? Are people drinking the groundwater? Is it a vapor intrusion issue or whatnot? And then, of course, the subsurface conditions themselves in terms of the geology, hydrogeology, and the contaminant distribution, fate and transport, and so on. So what's the status of the conceptual site model at your site? If it's something like this, which we kind of liken to the black box, then you probably need to update your conceptual site model and provide a little more definition than what we show here on slide 13. So some of the concepts that I'll touch on today that are covered in more detail in the document are shown on slide 14. We'll talk a little bit about Dean Apples themselves and how migration, transport of Dean Apple is important for the CFM. We'll talk about geology, the distribution of contaminants in all phases, whether it's vapor or sorbed or dissolved. And then we'll look at the response to treatment. We've got some figures that show in a simplistic way the evolution of a Dean Apple release and a source and how a plume might develop and what you could think about in terms of a framework for evaluating remedial options at those kind of sites. I do want to mention that we have another document that we have a link to later on in the training that has integrated Dean Apple site characterization that builds on what we're presenting here in IDSS and kind of takes it to the next level. It has even more detail about all the topics that are related to the conceptual site model that we show here. That is a separate document. It's a separate online training, and I encourage you to check that out as well. So when we're thinking of a conceptual site model at a Dean Apple site, there's a lot of things to take into account. We have to account for the physics and the chemistry of the subsurface release. So we've got some depictions here on this slide where maybe we've got the general Dean Apple release and transport shown here where it's migrating downward into the water table, generating a dissolved plume. There's some degradation going on perhaps. Groundwater is flushing from left to right across this little picture, and maybe there's sorption and even diffusion into this lower permeability zone down here. One of the key points that we want to make is that you need to consider all the different phases of contaminants at the site. Shown down here in the lower right part of the slide, you may have all of these phases present at your site. The Dean Apple itself, certainly aqueous contamination that's dissolved in the groundwater and moving down gradient. And then, as I mentioned, sorbed and vapor. It's also important to acknowledge the interphase mass transfer that can happen between these different phases. You can also have migration of vapor that comes either from the dissolved phase or even from the Dean Apple itself. And you also need to consider the phase of the Dean Apple in terms of how it relates to the porosity at the site. We've got a little graphic here showing an isolated Dean Apple blob next to some sand grains, and some in a saturated zone because there's water on either side of the Dean Apple. So along those lines, one thing that it is really important to understand is whether you have mobile Dean Apple or residual Dean Apple. So on this top depiction here, we show some soil grains and illustrate some water occupying this porosity and Dean Apple here. So in this case, the Dean Apple is mobile in that it is interconnected. It's its own phase that is capable of migrating. So this is not the Dean Apple dissolving into water and then the water moving. This is the Dean Apple itself migrating. This gets back to maybe what we thought was more common a couple of decades ago, in that large pools of Dean Apple could be present in the subsurface, maybe like we've depicted over here, and this Dean Apple itself is moving a long way and itself is covering a large area in the subsurface. That can happen, although what we're finding is that's not all that common. What is perhaps more common is residual Dean Apple. So the difference here is that in the residual phase, the Dean Apple is disconnected, the blobs and ganglia that are not capable of migrating. So you can see on our little cartoon here, the porosity that's occupied by the Dean Apple is a lot smaller, and it's separated. It's not continuous, whereas up here it was continuous. So the idea here is that this Dean Apple is still definitely a source of contaminant to the groundwater, but the Dean Apple itself is not moving. It's fixed in this location because it's being held in place by capillary forces, but it is dissolving into groundwater and causing a plume to emanate. So in this context, there's this whole topic of the heterogeneity of the geology. again, a couple of decades ago, we tended to think about things and try to conceptualize these sites in relatively simple ways, which maybe is illustrated by something like this. Where there just isn't a lot of complications shown on this diagram. It's something that is oversimplified is what we're finding. And in truth, you really need to have a better understanding than something like that at your site to be able to solve the issues. Down at the bottom right here is maybe a way that we would try to represent an intermediate complexity in a model. So we've gridded off the site and assigned properties and contaminant concentrations and whatnot to each model cell. But then what we realize is over here on the bottom left, reality is even more complex than any of those other depictions. So this is really the level of understanding that you need to strive for at a DNAPL site, where you look at different lithologies and what the saturation of the DNAPL is, like I mentioned before, and which of these zones are transporting contaminant mass versus which zones may be storing contaminant mass. That's this matrix storage idea, where these zones can sustain plumes at low to moderate concentrations over decades. So a little bit of a look into that concept, this idea of contaminant diffusion on slide 18. So let's say we have this oversimplified depiction of an aquifer here, where there's a semi-infinite sand that is underlain by a clay, and we have this sort of rectangular DNAPL pool that represents a discrete release that happened at some point in the past. During these early times, the DNAPL still exists. Maybe it's still mobile, at least for a certain point in time. You have mass that is dissolving from the DNAPL, moving down gradient, but you also have mass that is diffusing into these lower permeability zones because of the concentration gradient from here to here. And then let's look at some later time. Oh, one other point here. You can even have diffusion from the aqueous phase as the groundwater moves down gradient. Although the concentration gradient isn't as steep, you can still get diffusion away from the source area. Now, at a late time, let's say the DNAPL pool is gone. Maybe it's just back to a residual saturation. Now you've got a scenario where perhaps the sand has had lots and lots of pore volumes flushed through it. Maybe there was some kind of an active remedy that reduced concentrations in this sand, so they're pretty low. But now you've got this back diffusion that will cause contaminants to diffuse from these lower permeability zones back into the more permeable zones, which is what can sustain these low concentrations, these concentrations that can provide asymptotic response to treatment that we've all seen at sites like this. So let's take another look at this over a couple of different time periods, where we're looking at this simplified cross-section, and we're going to hypothesize this DNAPL release into this setting. So again, we've got this one high permeability zone. Maybe this is like the sand from the slide that we just looked at. And then we've got some low permeability lenses, and then the rest we're just going to call a medium permeability. So obviously we're not providing any kind of specific descriptions of these materials. And it is important to note that this is all relative. You could have a site where your high permeability zone, you know, maybe is a coarse sand or even a gravel, and these other zones are just fine sands. That kind of a permeability contrast can be enough to have some of these phenomena happen with back diffusion and matrix storage. It's not as though you need a 5 to 6 order of magnitude difference in hydraulic conductivity. So it's all relative, and so that's why we depict it like that here on this slide. So let's say we're in this early stage. So this is soon after the release. We still have the DNAPL phase itself that migrated through the vadose zone and into the saturated zone, but the DNAPL is still mobile, so we're above that residual saturation here. The DNAPL moves down gradient. You've got contaminants that have dissolved to form kind of a moderate concentration in yellow and then a lower concentration in green. And then maybe in this really high permeability zone, it's kind of already taking off and getting down gradient. At this stage, you don't see a lot of penetration into these low permeability zones yet, but you do have some diffusion from the high concentration zones to the low concentration zones. In a middle stage, everything is sort of evened out where the mobile DNAPL is gone and you've got kind of this moderate concentration everywhere, including the high permeability zone that's taking contaminants farthest down gradient. In this late stage, in this case, the DNAPL is long gone, and we've tried to depict here that contaminant mass has diffused all the way into these low permeability zones, and now they're acting as storage for contaminants. The mass that is tied up into these zones is diffusing back out into this medium permeability zones and even into the high permeability zone, although maybe it's not causing concentrations to go up too much because the flow in this zone is so high. So let's think about each one of these stages in terms of source treatment. The thinking a couple of decades ago was if you have a site where a DNAPL was released and you aggressively attack the source area, maybe with something like in situ thermal or in situ chemox or in situ bio, that you would essentially stop contributions from the source to the rest of the plume, and the plume would clean up very rapidly because you've cut the head off the snake, so to speak. Let's take a look at that in the context of these three stages. At an early stage, where the DNAPL itself is still present, if you're able to define that zone and delineate where the DNAPL is, and then apply a remedy to that area, you are going to have the kind of effect that I just mentioned, because this is where most of the mass is. If you can contain and even remediate that, you are going to stop a lot of this diffusion into low permeability zones across the length of the plume. But what about if you're doing in situ treatment at a middle or even a late stage site? Well, in this case, you're still thinking about doing a remediation where the release had occurred in the past, but as we know from the evolution of the plume, there isn't a lot of DNAPL left, so maybe you're certainly not going to get as much mass out, but what's the response going to be to removing mass from this area in these down gradient locations? Well, it's certainly not going to be as dramatic. And in fact, I've got a slide coming up that shows the modeling simulations that kind of inform the effect that you will have when you implement a source remedy on the down gradient plume flux. But the idea is the effectiveness of a source remedy depends on which stage of the DNAPL life cycle that you're in. All right, so here's the figure that I mentioned. This is this plume response to source treatment. So several years ago now, there was a group that did a bunch of modeling simulations that looked at what is the impact of removing a certain percentage or reducing the mass in the source by a certain percentage or a certain fraction, that's this axis. What is the response in terms of the flux reduction to the plume? So that's this axis. So I guess in a simple world, we would be right down the middle here. A one-to-one relationship would be if you remove 50% of the source mass, you would have a 50% reduction in flux to the plume. But what this paper documents is that there's a lot of other curves that fall both below and above that one-to-one relationship. So digging into that a little bit, if it's a homogeneous site in a relative sense, you have to remove a lot more mass to get the same reduction in plume flux as at a heterogeneous site. So let's take this 40% mass removal as an example. Let's say you are able to reduce the mass in the source by 40%. At a homogeneous site, you are only reducing the down gradient flux by something like 10% or less. However, at a heterogeneous site, if the more heterogeneous it is, the higher reduction that you have. And in this case, it might be more than 80%. So it depends on the amount of heterogeneity that you have at the site. Another point, if you kind of follow this curve on to the end, let's say that you've determined an 80% plume flux reduction is not nearly enough, and you need to get to something like 95. In order to kind of go the rest of the way up this curve to go from 80 to 95% you need to remove more than twice as much mass at these kind of sites. And this has to do with the idea that you do have these low permeability lenses that are storing mass, like we just talked about, that are just a lot harder to treat. So maybe in this first part of the source mass reduction, you're getting remediation to happen where the mass is more easily accessible. So anyway, this is an interesting study that was done a while back, but it shows kind of this idea that the relationship between the plume and the source is not as simple as what we once thought it was. So to kind of further this idea of conceptualizing the mass and the different phases at your site, our team adopted this 14-compartment model that was actually originally developed by Dr. Tom Snail and Dr. Chuck Newell a few years back. The idea here is to create a framework to visualize where the contaminant mass at your site resides. So we get to 14 compartments by having a source zone and a plume. Again, these are kind of a general classification. And then we group together the low permeability and the transmissive zones within each one of those. And then over here, we have the various phases, vapor, denapple, aqueous, and sorbed. And it's the 14-compartment model instead of the 16-compartment model because denapple in the plume is Na. So this is not something that is quantitative or something that you can, you know, calculate percentage of mass necessarily unless you collect a lot of data. But the idea here is that, you know, again, let's think back to an in situ remedy where we're injecting something like an oxidant or a bioremediation amendment. That amendment may only go into the transmissive zones in the source area. So you may only be addressing a couple of these compartments with one of your remedial technologies, and you're not addressing a lot of the other ones. So this can kind of help you think about why maybe you're not getting the response or the results that are desired, because these sites can be really complicated and the mass can reside in a lot of phases. So these arrows also represent mass transfer that could happen between the different phases. So you get the idea that even with this kind of simplification of the framework, it can get pretty complicated. So let's overlay the 14-compartment model to those three stages that I mentioned before, the early, middle, and late stage. So during the early stage, we're mostly in the transmissive zone in the source because that's where the denapple is going to go first, the path of least resistance, so to speak. And most of the mass is going to be in the denapple phase in the transmissive zone. So maybe we assign that a high, and then the other phases are moderate in the transmissive zones, and all the low permeability zones are still low. In the middle stage, again, we've kind of had everything even out, so maybe we assign everything as moderate in terms of where the mass resides in these different compartments. At a late stage site, now we're to the point where, again, the transmissive zones maybe have had lots and lots of flushing or maybe even some remediation, and the amount of mass in those zones is low in the source and even in the plume. Now we've got the situation where the low permeability zones have stored a lot of the mass that's remaining. So maybe in this case we've got moderate in aqueous and sorbed in both the source area and in the plume. That's an important point. there's mass in these low permeability zones far away from the initial release because of diffusion into those zones when the plume first migrated past those areas. So one final point about the conceptual site model at denapple sites is that you cannot ignore the vapor phase. Vapor intrusion is a big issue. That pathway can be really important and, in fact, can be the driver at some of these sites if the conditions are right. I personally worked on one here in the Denver area where there were chlorinated ethenes that were above kind of some of the most conservative standards But the levels that were driving remediation at that site were based on vapor intrusion. And the action level that was derived for groundwater was actually below the MCL because that concentration at that site was creating a vapor intrusion risk for some homes. So anyway, this is a key element of conceptual site model at DNAPL sites. You have to be careful about oversimplifying things. Where, you know, maybe it's not enough to just do a simple screening calculation and then write off this pathway. You have to have a clear understanding of the migration and transport processes to really know if vapor intrusion is an issue, especially if you still have, you know, DNAPL that's hung up in the VADO zone at a shallow site. So that's definitely something that you have to watch out for. So to wrap up, the conceptual site model section, we just want to emphasize that you really need to have this understanding of, you know, the source and the plume and how those are related, what the transport processes are, and the exposure pathways, again, including vapor intrusion. It's useful to think about the stage of your site, whether it's early, middle, or late. And a point on that that I didn't mention before, it's not necessarily just tied to the time since the release. It depends on the conditions at the site. If you have a site where groundwater flux is very low, you could have a release that maybe is several years old, but you're still in the early stage because the DNAPL is still present because it just hasn't been dissolved away. And conversely, you can have sites that get to late stage pretty quickly if it was a small release at a site maybe that has high groundwater flux. So the bottom line, like I mentioned before, if we don't understand the problem, we probably can't solve it. And here is the link to that integrated DNAPL site characterization document that I mentioned before. There are active training seminars this year going on for that one as well. Another document that could be useful to review and another training is the mass flux and mass discharge document, which was developed by the same IDSS team, but it's its whole separate training and document that can provide some useful information for conceptual site models at DNAPL sites as well. So that concludes the conceptual site model section. Now I will turn it over to Alex McDonald to walk us through the remedial objectives portion.
Thanks, Ryan. Everyone should be looking at slide 29, especially those of you who are controlling your own slides. During our development of this document and doing all our investigations, our team came up with a problem that was continually coming up was that the remedial action objectives really weren't being developed that were clear and concise and that you could actually measure, you could actually determine how you're going to comply with those things. And so we decided within this framework of a site strategy document that we needed to put a section in there on establishing remedial objectives that were an improvement over the way we currently are doing those. And, you know, in the last part of this slide, you see we're trying to make the process to be there's a bunch of attributes there at the bottom that we're going to try to give those to you and how you can make your remedial objectives do a much better job on your project in the future. Let's move over to slide 30. So in our analysis, we came up that there were basically two types of objectives. We called them absolute objectives and functional objectives. Now, the absolute objectives are the ones you usually see, the broad-based ones are protection of public health and environment, restoring the aquifer to beneficial uses, the mom and apple pie things. Sure, we all want to do those things, but how do you comply with those? How do you measure those? So we determined that in order to achieve those absolute objectives, we would set functional objectives beneath each one of those absolute objectives. And those functional objectives, which would be the ones that you can actually determine how you're going to meet those absolute objectives. So as an example, we're trying to clean up a groundwater aquifer. One of the things we need to do is reduce the pollutant load down to that aquifer. And so we would set a functional objective on how we're going to do that by, you know, removing the source, treating the source, maybe even pumping and treating groundwater to get that groundwater back into a usable aquifer. So these functional objectives, by by achieving compliance with each functional objective, by default, you're going to meet your absolute objective. Let's see how we do this sort of thing. So what we concluded is we want to make these objectives SMART. We found this this SMART criteria developed by someone else. We thought they were a good idea. And, of course, everyone loves an acronym. So here we have SMART. SMART, what does it mean? It means to make these five attributes found within each one of our functional objectives, not the absolute objectives, our functional objectives. So S, specific. So you need to be very specific and detailed in that objective. Instead of saying we will clean up the groundwater, well, as example, we'll clean up the groundwater to 5 micrograms per liter TCE, a drinking water standard, as an example. Then we also have to make them measurable. In other words, we can't have something so nebulous you can't measure it. Well, that specificity we just put for TCE, yes, we can measure that. It's easy to measure. We can grab samples. We can do that. We determine how you're going to take those samples over what aerial extent and that sort of thing. So you can measure it. You want to also make them attainable. What good is a goal if you can't obtain it? So you must make this realistically within the time frame and the availability of resources. You can't make something impossible to attain, unless you have an unlimited amount of money or time to do it. You have to make it relevant. In other words, this groundwater is, for example, in California area, we have some areas where we have basically salt water from past geological activity. And that salt water is not usable for drinking water service. We wouldn't have an objective that would say you must restore that water to drinking water purposes. So it has to be relevant. Time-bound is the one we came up with the most interest in and discrepancies in and trying to figure out how to set this time-bound element. But we all agree that each of the objectives must have an endpoint so that you can figure out, yes, we're going to achieve something by a certain period of time. And let's go to slide 32 where we'll discuss this time frame objective. There is quite a bit of discussion within our group on how to do this time frame. For example, if we have sites that could take, it's estimated, a couple hundred years to clean up. Well, how do you know that? How can you determine today that it's going to take 200 years, and how can you measure compliance along the way to show that you're actually getting towards that objective? So we came up with a time frame for each one of the functional objectives that shouldn't exceed 20 years. We did that because we want to show accountability. The people making the decisions now should be held accountable for those decisions. So hopefully they're still around within that period of time to be responsible for the decisions that you've made, that objective. Also, within 20 years, over a long period of time, you have a natural variation in contaminant concentrations. So that variability happens fairly quickly. And so over a very long period of time, there's so much variation going, you can't account for that. So we try to shrink that time frame down so that the objective is less prone to influence by those changing conditions. In addition, our models predictions, over a much longer period of time aren't that good. So we try to shrink that down so that, the uncertainty is much less in our prediction. And then scientific understanding, technical ability is changing, it seems like every day some new technology comes out, some new process comes out, some new model comes out. So we don't want to, we want to be able to take that into account over time in setting these things. So our 20 years, you figure if you have a 200-year cleanup, you'll have an objective saying you're going to do X by 20 years. And when that 20 years comes around, you're going to determine whether you're complying with it. And you will set another functional objective 20 years from now for the next 20 years. So it's not like it's something that actually can be measured along the time. And you can actually check your measurements to see if you're getting close to within that 20-year period. And if not, maybe you need to change your remedy. Or maybe you need to change your objective. So that all comes into play. So the time frame is the trickiest part of all those objectives, attributes that we're trying to deal with. Let's go to an example. Within our document, we have two examples, a complex example and a simple example. Given time and the ability to do this over the Internet, we're going to give you the easy example site. So this is a real site somewhere in the Midwest. It was a dry cleaner. unlike there's thousands of these around, drop PCE into the soil, subsurface. So we have soils contaminated with PCE. You have groundwater contaminated with PCE. And this person owns this property. The dry cleaner is no longer there. They want to remake it into a mall. So, and one of the key things in this whole thing is that he wants to do this and clean up the property so there actually has no more restrictions on the property. So he's willing to spend more money to clean up the site and not have any land use covenants on them or any other restrictions, vapor intrusion, mitigation measures, anything of that nature. So that alone drives a bunch of the cleanup standards that are being produced. So if you look on the left-hand side, we have, if you have a new building, if you don't do anything, you have a potential for contamination of PCE from soil vapor into the building from the soil contamination, off gas off of groundwater cause the same problems. Then there's a potential for exposure to the contaminated soils themselves if you come in contact with them. So you have to basically deal with the contamination within the soils and the groundwater and soil vapor. So we have, they set up cleanup standards. And the numbers we have down the bottom are just an example. They're not true developed for this particular site. For example, so you have a 40 microgram per kilogram PCE in soil, and that was determined that concentration wouldn't cause indoor air or ambient air to have a dermal exposure that would cause a problem. So you had to get down to that within the soil column itself. And then what about off-gas off the groundwater? Well, this particular location, they said 8 micrograms per liter PCE in groundwater would also cause an indoor air issue. And then if you wanted to restore this water to drinking water purposes, then you'd have to get at least down to the drinking water standard. So by meeting the drinking water standard, by default, you meet the indoor air, the ambient air standards. So the idea was that he needed this done, and that he needed it done so that he could start building the mall in a certain period of time. So let's move to, we have this example in your mind. We're going to go through now process of setting an objective that's going to be SMART. Okay, so first off, we have to develop the functional objectives, absolute objectives, right? And then functional objectives. So absolute objectives, there's two of them. Not all of this isn't all-inclusive, but the two ones we're going to show you here today, protection of human health and environment, and to redevelop the mall area. That's not the environmental issue, but that is the issue for the property owner. So we come up with a generic functional objective. We haven't assigned attributes, the SMART attributes, to it at all. So and I'm only going to go through one of them because there's a whole bunch of them. So just one is vapor intrusion indoor air objective, soils pathway. So we need to come up with an objective to do that. So we came up with, you reduce the concentrations of volatile organics in the vato zone that will allow a no further action for unrestricted use. Remember, he wants unrestricted use, he doesn't want any vapor mitigation measures, so with no engineering or administrative controls required. So that is going to be our functional objective, one of the functional objectives, to meet the protection of human health and environment and to redevelop the mall area with unrestricted use. So that's not SMART. It's there. So let's make this SMART. So we'll go to the next slide. And how do we do that? So to make this SMART, remember we had to meet specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time-bound. So we modified that functional objective to say reduce concentrations of volatile organics in the vato zone to less than 40 micrograms per kilogram, very specific, within 6 months. That's very time-specific. That was basically time-bound. And the 6 months was not due to any need on the environmental end to get it done that fast, but the developer needed it within 6 months so that he could get the loans and do the processes so he could get the mall developed in his according to his time frame. So go further within that objective. It will allow a no further action for unrestricted use with no engineering or administrative controls required. So if you look at that, have we made it SMART? So let's go through the five criteria. Yes, it's specific, 40 micrograms per kilogram, very specific. Measurable, yes, you can measure that. Obviously, you can take confirmation samples, either soil vapor, however you're going to do that. You can take soil samples. Achievable, yes, you can achieve that. If you remember the diagram in the back, depth to groundwater is 15. To the groundwater is like 15 to 20 feet. You can easily excavate that material out, or you can use soil vapor extraction, or potentially in situ chemical oxidation. So you have various measures to be able to do that. So yes, it is achievable. Is it relevant? Sure it is. Intended use of the property, what he wants to get out of it, this definitely is relevant to clean this up so you can put this property back to beneficial use. Time bound, yeah, we made it 6 months. We might, you know, and if it wasn't due to the property owner, maybe that 6 months might be a year or so. You know, you wouldn't have to rush through it to get that done. So hopefully with that, you can now see how we develop a smart remedial objective. I want to basically point you to that was a very simplistic case. You go to our document and look at the complex case to give you a much better feel for how you're going to do these things on a more complex site. And so with that, I'm going to turn this back over to Juliana for our first question and answer period.
Thanks, Alex. We now have time to take your questions. So everyone is welcome to send that in using the Q&A pod in the lower right. If you're on the phone line, #6 to unmute, and you're welcome to jump in with a question. I'll also remind you at this point, at the end of the training class, we do ask that you fill out our feedback form. So in the middle section, the related links, the middle right, the fourth item down takes you to the feedback form. We really appreciate you taking just a few minutes to give us your feedback. We do use the information both to improve today's training course, but we're also developing new courses, and your feedback does help us improve those new courses as well. The advantage you get from filling out the feedback is you can create a certificate of participation for yourself, and right now it's only through the feedback form. So be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify that you attended. Once you submit, the system will generate that certificate of participation for you. If you forget to check the box, no problem. Just go back, check the box, submit again, and that's the only way right now to get that certificate to generate. We're looking for a few questions to come in, so people may be typing questions, so we'll give people a little bit of time to type in some questions. While we're waiting for some questions to come in, can some of our trainers tell us about the new ITRC team on fractured bedrock?
This is Chuck Newell. Yeah, there's a team that's looking in this, sort of taking some of the lessons learned from this particular IDSS document and thinking about things like matrix diffusion. That affects some of these fractured rock sites a lot, and applying it to this really complex hydrogeology. And so the work has been going on for, I think, about 2 years, something like that. There's going to be a big meeting coming up at the end of March in New Orleans and try to sort of flange out some of the key concepts of the document and then sort of issue that. So if you've got a fractured rock site, interested in how some of these comments that are introduced here in this training might affect you at your site, plus knowing a lot more about the tools that are out there and the ways to think about and analyze the data, then this ITRC fractured rock documents can be pretty good.
Yeah, just to add to that, Chuck, this is Ryan. That document, it's not intended to be completely comprehensive in terms of covering everything, but what its focus is really what is unique and different at fractured rock sites when it comes to both characterization and remediation. So it really kind of dovetails with the other documents that we've put out related to characterization and the IDSS here. That one, the intent is really to focus on uniqueness of fractured rock sites.
Thanks. We've had a question come in. If you inherit a site with installed wells, probably screened in the most permeable zone, how can you tell what stage you are in? Early stage, middle stage, or late? Do you essentially need to install some new wells or hydropunch samples to get an idea of whether back diffusion is an issue?
Well, this is Chuck. Yeah, I'll take a first stab at it. I guess there's one idea is that with these sites, we're getting this sort of a conceptual model that Ryan talked about, is that we spent a lot of our time putting in wells and looking at these transmissive zones, these sands and gravels and things of that nature. Look at those concentrations. But if there's been 40 years of diffusion that's going into silts and clays, then in some ways that's like dark matter out there in the galaxy. It's dark matter that we sort of know is there, but we don't really measure it too much. So there are a couple of different options for you if you do inherit this site. Number one, yeah, just do some more drilling. But in this case, it's high-resolution drilling in these low permeability units, particularly right at the interfaces, and then sort of pulling up samples, then you can measure and understand that math that's in that low permeability zones. Now, another way is to apply some simple modeling tools. The ESTCP funded the Matrix Diffusion Toolkit, and it just says that, you know, if I've got a clay that's in contact with the sand had this plume at a certain concentration over 30 or 40 years, how might that affect me? And that would give you some sort of another perspective on how to think about that matrix diffusion. So two options there.
Yeah, Chuck, and one other point I would make is our IDSS team and especially the new DNAPL characterization team, we like to make the distinction between characterization and monitoring. So depending on your site, if the kind of profiling tools and high-res tools that Chuck referred to are available to you and you can use those at your site, those are a really good way to characterize the site, which will help you understand how much mass is in those zones. We really try to encourage the use of monitoring wells for monitoring a remedy or, you know, assessing changes over time and concentrations and things like that. So we always try to separate characterization from monitoring.
Good point. Mm-hmm.
Is there any way to quantify the residual DNAPL present as diffusion in the low permeable zones?
Well, Chuck, I'll take the first swing at that one. And that's a tough question. And I was involved in some of the early training that said if you have concentrations above a certain amount, then you know, you've got this DNAPL there and you need to get it out. But then we begin to change our conceptual model, and that picture's changing. And as Ryan talked about, we think that there may be many sites out there where that DNAPL basically has dissolved away and it's gotten a low permeability zone. So just some key things about the terminology. When we talk about DNAPL, we're actually talking about the individual blobs of oil that still may be there. And then one reason we don't see that a lot of these DNAPL sites, and maybe that's because that stuff has actually gone away. It's changed to the aqueous phase and then diffused into the low permeability zone. So it's a tough way to sort of quantify that and understand it, but there's this idea that maybe if you're looking for these DNAPL blobs, the actual oil, and you don't see them, maybe it makes sense if that's an old site and all that stuff is sort of diffused away.
How long usually does it take for the plume and source to transition from early stage to late stage?
Yeah, this is Ryan. Like I mentioned, it really is dependent on the site, because there can be sites where the DNAPL, if it's a discrete release, it can flush away very quickly. And there's other sites where it hangs around for a long time. And it also depends on the DNAPL itself. If it's a chlorinated ethene, like TCE or PCE, you might get to a late stage a lot faster than at other kinds of DNAPL sites, like maybe creosote or something like that.
And this is Chuck. Just to add, there, we have a lot of discussions about this with different people, and there are different perspectives. If you ask Dr. Bernie Cooper at Queens College, he would say there's not many of these late-stage sites. There's always some DNAPL that's left, or usually somewhere out there that just hasn't dissolved away. You know, my perspective, maybe Mike Annable from Florida and these other folks are saying that a lot of these TCEE sites, it's higher solubility than the point that Ryan made. Maybe that has dissolved away, and that's why we haven't seen DNAPL at many of these sites, because it's gone away, but that source is still there, and that's why a key definition of a source, it's a source where DNAPL is or was, because if you did have DNAPL there, that's high concentrations, and it would have fed in this matrix diffusion and loaded up those clays and silts.
So would we expect a site to quickly become a late-stage site if only clays were logged in the depth interval of the DNAPL impact?
This is Chuck, and there's a great paper by Beth Parker some time ago where she looked at fractured clays, and so that was their domain. John Cherry was a co-author, and they did these calculations on how quickly DNAPL would sort of dissolve away and go into the clays if it was a fractured clay system. And the numbers were pretty amazing. If you had trichloroethylene, which is something that's got this higher solubility, you might think of these fractures as being like if you had a big block of clay and there's a piece of paper or cardboard in it and you pull it out, it's this vertical plane that's in there. And so if you imagine that the TCE is spilled and it's pure form, it sort of coats that vertical plane like peanut butter or jelly or something like that. But then over a couple of years for TCE, and it depends how thick that fracture is and other factors, but that stuff would go away pretty quick. Longer for PCE, lower solubility, but that one would say, yeah, that stuff, if you have TCE and you got these regular or small fractures, the TCE doesn't stand a chance. It would dissolve away.
Thank you. We'll go ahead and continue on with the next section of the training. We hope to have more time at the end of today's class to ask more questions. So I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Chuck Newell at GSI Environmental.
Great. Chuck Newell here, and we're going to go on to basically to the treatment technology section. And this is sort of a little bit about the good, bad, and the ugly a little bit. And one would be that, you know, the good is that you know, the audience out there, I know you guys are intelligent. You know the difference between seepage velocity and Darcy velocity. You're Renaissance people where you know a little bit about geology, biology, chemistry. So you have these skills in thinking about these sites. But the bad is that this document that we wrote says that cleaning up these Dean Apple sites, it is a daunting challenge. And it's this combination of different constraints. And Ryan talked about the matrix diffusion, which is this big one that's come up. And we haven't been very successful at cleaning up very many of these sites. And so that's the bad. And then the ugly is if you go into a site and you do your best, you apply technologies, and you don't clean it up, that people would say, hey, you screwed up. You didn't restore this to groundwater. So maybe one of the theme of the document, particularly this chapter here, is trying to set expectations. And maybe that's the attainable part of the SMART goals that Alex talked about. And so we're really talking about what you can get from these technologies, and that was one of the big themes. So on slide 37, we've got some of these different questions. How do you avoid the trap of relying on a single remedial technology that won't do the job? How do you consider site characteristics and goals when you're trying to pick technologies? And maybe do I want to combine them and use multiple ones to do that? So we're going to talk about that. This is chapter 4 in the document. Let me see if I can move ahead here. Four sections in the basically the document. The first one here is this remediation technologies and assessing performance. And that's really the big dog. It's the one that's really got the most text in there, most pages, most time we spend in there. But we also considered section 4.2, coupling technologies, how you want to add these things together, a little bit like Legos, and what are some of the rules and thinking and strategies you might have that. And then section 4.3 goes into transitioning to other technologies. When do I make that switch? When do I dump the old one and bring in the new one? And then finally, we have a short example in section 4.4 that goes through that. So we'll talk about all those different things coming up in the next couple minutes in the training. Okay, so what is in this chapter 4, sort of on a high perspective, I hope that was part of this team that helped write it, and I think it's got a good summary of these key technologies and their performance. And but there's some things that are in there. There's no discussion of technology niches or sweet spots, and part of it was we're in this table, and everybody had a really good, firm idea of which technologies were applicable to what type of sites, and, you know, chemistry, hydrogeology, but they were all different. So in some ways, we just said there's other documents that are out there that might help you decide some of these site-specific things, so we just didn't go into that one. So no universal consensus by the IDSS team on that. But one thing we did try to do is really think about this in terms of how do you fit technologies into this 14-compartment model, and part of it's this expectation. What can you get out of these technologies? And our main unit of currency here is this thing that sounds like it's a, you know, a Buddhist chant or something, but it's ooms, okay, orders of magnitude, and we'll talk a lot about that. So moving on, then we've got in the document, it's sort of standing on the shoulders of giants, as we like to say, that it talks about these different technologies, and this is the nerd stuff a lot of us really like, but we talk about physical removal technologies, excavation, multi-phase extraction, then the thermal stuff, and we give references for all these things. Chemical, biological, we talk about chemical ox, chemical reduction, bioremediation, M&A, and in containment, we talk about pump and treat, barriers, and things like this. Notice there are a lot of ITRC documents in here as the backup for this, reference papers and things of that nature. So that's sort of the basis of where we started on this. Now, on this next one is this 14-compart model, and this is how we think about applying technologies to this thing. So this has got the 14-compartment model, sort of the colored columns in here. You count those up there. Those are the 14. Source and plume, low permeability zone, silts and clays, and your sands are over in here. But there are these other columns, and the idea is that if you can figure out how many ohms, orders of magnitude reduction, you can get from a technology, you can put them in these gray boxes and just do a subtraction, and then you and all the site stakeholders can see, this is what I'm going to end up with. And just so you can say, well, I might have some twos in here somewhere that might sustain out there because it's hard to get into these clays and things of this nature. So part of this chapter goal was, how do I get the numbers to put into these gray boxes with a question mark? How many orders of magnitude can I expect to happen on this? So why are we talking about orders of magnitude? Why is this ohms thing such a big deal? And it's because the universe is all about orders of magnitude. And just some examples, you know, earthquakes or Richter scale, that's factors of 10 of damage. Something I'm familiar with, hurricanes, the Saffir-Simpson scale, category 4, category 5, tenfold increase in damage, star magnitude. But our business, definitely orders of magnitude. You know, when you talk about hydraulic conductivities, we sort of just spout out this stuff. Hey, it's a 10 to the minus 5 centimeter per second silt, 10 to the minus 2 sand, things of that nature. Think about your plume maps. Do you ever see a plume map for TCE that has 1 milligram per liter, 2 milligram per liter, 3 milligram per liter contours? No way. No, we have, you know, 0.1, we've got 1, we've got 10, we've got 100. You know, those are the powers of tens in there. So when I'm talking about ohms, you have to think about what reduction you can get. A 90% reduction, well, that's one factor of 10. That's one order of magnitude, one ohm. 99.9%, 3 ohms. And then we got an equation in here. 70% reduction is about half an ohm. So we're thinking about that as sort of our shorthand for thinking about performance of these technologies. And this is a little bit about our goals. So if you start out at 50,000 micrograms per liter TCE, and the MCL is 5, you need 4 ohms, 99.99% reduction to get that. So that's sort of setting expectations. If this is what you need to get to restore it and your technologies can't get you 4 ohms, then that's a serious consideration. So now let's move ahead and talk about this key question. Well, that all sounds great. There's the question marks in that 14-compartment model. Where do you get the dang ohms? So number one is option one. I know there's a lot of experience out there. People have worked on these sites. They've got some idea of what those before groundwater concentrations were. They did some sort of treatment. What are the after ones? Then number three here, vendors can really do a lot. And they know a lot about that. They apply a lot of it. So a lot of great knowledge there. But we're mostly going to talk about option two is data from the scientific literature. And sometimes call these multiple site studies, or we call them plumathon studies. But there are a lot of these different studies that say, this is what happened. This was the before, and this was the after, in between of doing some sort of treatment. So a lot of good references on that, and there's some new ones that have come out since the document came out in 2011 I just briefly talk about. But Geosyntec did a really good document called DNEPL Test. It's a software system you can download from ESTCP. There's a paper by Hans Stroh. Send me an email. I can send you the paper that sort of summarizes all this stuff. A new report by one of my colleagues, Travis McGuire, that expands this universe of things. But we're going to talk about what the scientific literature says you can get from these ohms. So here's this document about the multiple site studies, some example papers that we use to come to the document. Hey, performance of DNEPL source depletion at 59 sites. State of the practice reviews of thermal. Paul Johnson and his team did this. We've got the Seagrist at School of Mines did a big study of ISCO. And these are papers of independent researchers. They're careful before and after methodology. You can sort of repeat the calculations that they're saying. They describe a spectrum of sites. It's real data. It's not anecdotal. And several studies are described in these peer-reviewed papers. So that's maybe the strong point about this multiple site stuff and sort of looking at this. And this is what the medical field does. You know, if you're going to do a new drug, they give it to half the people, the other people don't. They do these stats and see. So in some ways, this is our version of that clinical trial where we're looking, what was the outcome that happened when we did these treatments? So here's just some examples of what you might see in some of these. So this is from my colleague Travis McGuire at GSI, wrote a paper that called the 59 Site Study. looking at before and after concentrations, and this y-axis is the percent reduction that was observed in the source zone, and these are box plots where this is the median value, that's the 75th percentile, that's the 25th percentile, min and max. But as you can see here, these technologies are in general giving you somewhere between a 90% reduction, 99% reduction, and 1 to 2 ohms is this key sort of rule of thumb that's out there. And this is bioremediation sites. This is the Segrist data from his study, Paul Johnson's studies in here. So this is one way to think about it and sort of give you this information. And then we'll go to a little more detail about this in the next couple of slides. But there are some people say use caution about this. They say, I hate these plumathon studies. They're not site-specific. Some of them lump pilot scale and full scale. They don't account for the fact that some people are plowing ahead with a thermal treatment. They get to some endpoint they like, and they turn it off. And they could have cleaned the whole thing up if they just had gone further. They don't account for if the people doing it are experts or rookies. And the other ones, we're a lot better now. Some of these are studies that were done there. So there's been more analysis, this updated McGuire study that was just released this year. Send me an email, I can send you this ESTCP study, said that this full-scale lump scale didn't appear to be a factor. We haven't got a lot better over, say, the last 10 or 12 years in terms of doing these treatments. And so anyway, vigorous debate about the usefulness of it, but for the IDSS, we said, no, this is some good data. We're putting it into the document. So let's keep going. I'm just going to give you a quick summary of some of these different technologies and a little more insight on what some of the ohms look like. Excavation, well, if you can excavate the whole thing, then you can get that 4 ohms, 5 ohms, if you can get it all out. So that's a key part of our technology. Inventory, we do a lot of excavation in our business. Thermal remediation, Paul Johnson study, Jennifer Kingston was sort of the lead author in this, looked at 14 sites. They were less than equal to 1 order of magnitude reduction in this mass discharge metric at 9 sites, greater than 2 ohms or only at 4 sites. So this is even thermal that they can do this. Now, some of the vendors say they can do better, particularly in the vadose zone. You can really get a high number of ohms. And then, but it's this is the record that was at these 14 sites at this time, and this is sort of saying that sometimes people are missing part of the source. It's just a difficult thing to do. Into chemical oxidation. This is the Colorado School of Mines study, median 0.3 ohms for these chlorinateds, and that they appeared to rebound a lot more. The McGuire study says maybe the performance is a little bit better than this, but there's this idea there is this rebound that's more prevalent, the chemical oxidation. In situ chemical reduction, I'm going to put some sort of iron in the ground. And this is a technology developed at Colorado State by Tom Sale, deep soil mixing where you sort of blend in bentonite and ZVI clay. Because you're doing all the mixing, you're destroying the heterogeneity. No more low permeability zones, median 1.7 ohms in a couple of studies that they looked at. Let's keep going. Enhanced bioremediation. Hey, this looks pretty good. 1.3 order of magnitude reduction for this series of, I think it was about 20 sites, but that was for the parent compound, TCE or PCE. If you look at total CVOCs, well, it was a lot worse because you're generating these daughter products only 0.4 ohms. This is a paper that I wrote, and I looked at 26 sites, what happened over 9 years in these source zones, and there's no DNAPL in these source zones, sort of maybe lower concentration sites, 0.6 ohms. So if you wait long enough, you can start to approach some of those performance of these other technologies at certain sites. So some information there. And I think the last one we have is containment. And so there's this thinking, particularly complex sites. At some point, maybe we're thinking more about containing these. So Pump of Treats one. We looked at permeable reactive walls, and the 6 sites, there was a 0.8 order of magnitude reduction in TC in the wall. But there is people noticing that at some of these zero valent iron wall sites, the down gradient concentrations aren't maybe as good as this because of matrix diffusion coming in from down gradient of the wall. Low permeability barriers, these like slurry walls, a pretty old study, 1998, said 83% of these barriers around these sites met their objectives. And then there's solidification stabilization, not used very much in our field. Okay, so that's a little bit about the technology sort of lineup and things of that nature. We're going to go to the next topic and talk about Section 4.2, technology coupling. And we say, okay, well, a lot of times you just don't go with one sort of tool. You're going to attack it with multiple tools and sort of combine them either temporally, you know, do A then B, spatially, source zone and plume, are simultaneous. And so we said the most common or sort of coupling of these is temporal. I'm going to do my intensive technology followed by a passive one, and then a different technology maybe for the source and plume. But we do a lot of this. Almost every site is going to be, I think, Richard Nixon says we're all Keynesians now. At some point in our sites, we're all going to be M&A people. And so any technology followed by M&A is going to be a coupling at most of our sites. In the past, they thought that there are some opposing combinations. Oh, never do ISCO followed by bio because this reduction was thought to be permanent. That's not proven to be the case. So we talk a little bit about some of that thinking and knowledge coming from that. Then a little bit more about the rationale for coupling, and really we're thinking about what are some of the factors that go in there, and this is just sort of a list of them, how much mass you have, what are the fluxes, the concentrations, what other factors change over time. Also, remediation objectives can change, or your understanding of risk changes. Some sites, all of a sudden, dioxane shows up. Oh, I got to start thinking about what I'm going to do about the 1,4-dioxane, and that goes multiple contaminant classes maybe in there. Now, one last thing we did sort of in this section was this technology compatibility matrix. And in some ways, this is a little bit reminds me of, Match.com. You've seen those commercials, and you're trying to, maybe you're trying to match up two friends of yours. And you might think about, is Harry and Sally, what are they like? Harry and Sally may be generally compatible. And that's the example in our field. There's a table that we have that sort of has all the list of technologies on the y-axis and x-axis, and we talk about in each square here, many of them are generally compatible. An example is thermal remediation followed by in-situ bio. That extra heat might really help some of these guys, might work. But then Joe and Susan, you might think, oh, what a disaster. No way. Those guys are going to fight. They're likely incompatible. In-situ reduction followed by in-situ oxidation, that's probably not a great thing to do. And then finally, we have this other category, and maybe this is, Fred and Monica, something like that. Well, they're potentially compatible, but they're not an anticipated couple. I just don't see it. And this, like bioremediation, then followed by an intensive technology like surfactant flushing. So a little bit about the Match.com, that section 4.2 that we go in there and discuss that. What are the transitioning between the technologies? You might think about the contaminant concentrations. If they get below a certain level, then I can go do something else. Do I have any free phase left? That's a key thing. At some of these sites, you really want to get out that if the pool DNAPL if you can, if it's a small enough site. Contaminant lineage, thinking about parents versus daughters. Site conditions created during the method, am I turned everything anaerobic? I've got maybe metals coming out. And then there's a key one is, really think about cost per unit of contaminant that's destroyed in there. So let me go to the remedy transition steps, and we've got a couple of these. We go in there, you do this remedy, you build this thing, you do process performance monitoring, you do data evaluation. Are we making progress? Yes. Stick with it. Keep going. You just want to sort of, continue the grind that's happening in here. And then, and here you've got this decision point. Well, I got this thing. Should I optimize it? Things like pump and treat. Maybe I want to change the pumping rates or add some more wells or do I want to add some more injection points if I'm doing a series of injections? You might do this. And then there's some decision, this thing has done all it's sort of meant to do. I want to transition to the next remedy, and that's the way we're thinking about that. So here's just a brief example in Section 4 to pull it all together, and this is a very simple example, so it makes it easy to do the training particularly, but we want to sort of in this example couple this idea of 14-compartment model with these different places where this mass might be, and the ooms, the orders of magnitude, and put that in there, and we're going to come up with that sort of semi-complicated chart, and then think about remedy performance, and this all answers this question, will I reach my objectives, what are the expectations, is it attainable in Alex's sort of SMART goals? So here's this thing, this one's simpler, I'm just doing this source, I'm not showing the plume here, the different colors, these are equivalent concentrations of, 1,000 microgram per liter of, say, TCE in red, hundreds are oranges, 10 micrograms per liter are the yellows, and then greens are ones are close in there. And before, we're saying we've got these different concentrations. There's a lot of concentrations sorbed on here, a lot of mass. But if I do this excavation, I think I can get three orders of magnitude. And if I subtract all these out, then basically I'm really in this green zone, maybe a couple of micrograms per liter left at the end. both in low permeability zone and the transmissive zone. However, if I was doing something like pump and treat, well, I could probably get some, maybe one or two orders of magnitude, you know, in my performance in this aqueous phase, but I probably would not affect this low permeability zone. I wouldn't affect these at all. So these would be zero and zero for pump and treat, where over here I might be two, you know, orders of magnitude in here. So you sort of talk about this. There's a report that Tom Stahel and I did that sort of talks about how you can estimate ohms for different technologies from ESTCP. Again, send me an email. I can send you that document in there. Okay, so I'm going to wrap up with section four here and sort of talk about what we tried to present here and sort of put together in this IDSS document. Three important concepts, you know. Remediation is an order of magnitude affair. You got to be thinking the tens, you know, and think about 90%, 99%, and that 90% reduction of mass seems great to my brother or my mom, but then it's really not, because in this environmental stuff, it's orders of magnitude, and if I go from 5,000 to 500, but my goal is a 5 microgram per liter number, man, I still got a ways to go down that road. Ohms go into this 14-compartment model. You can do this remediation analysis if you think about how different technologies can affect things. And, you know, pump and treat can't reach in there and get stuff out of that low permeability zone. So thermal might have a better chance of getting that out. Get your ohms from experience, multiple site studies, or from technology experts that are out there. And we talked about this. The document sort of really emphasizes these multiple site studies, the good research that's out there. There's been more since then in terms of particularly one recent ESTCP study. The 245 sites are in that one by my colleague Travis McGuire. Again, we can send you that. Let me know if you need me to send you that report. Coupling technologies that we talked about, you know, key examples would be, you know, do something intensive, then more something more passive. You know, I'm going to do technology A in the source versus technology B in the plume. And we have this match.com type compatibility matrix to figure out which of these things make good couples. Mm-hmm. And then we sort of have some ideas about transitioning, about thinking, should I optimize first or go on to the next one, and give you some rules or considerations for how all that stuff works and how you might consider that. So I think that does it for section four, and I'm going to blast ahead and sort of go through the section five where we talk about the monitoring. So we're going to, in some ways, take our hard hats off. We're not doing this implementation, this engineering of stuff, but we're going to try to monitor this. And so it's really about those 40-mil VOAs. It's about the on-course samplers and really thinking about what am I doing out there. And so in the flow chart here, we're looking at these different things is, you know, how do you design a monitoring program that assesses your progress towards reaching your functional objectives? What data should you collect to evaluate remedy performance? So it's all in here is thinking about getting that data to sort of seeing are you on this glide path and things like that. So let's go to that in a little more detail. So Ryan talked about this, and there are different types of monitoring. He talked about that there's characterization versus sort of this long-term monitoring. And in long-term monitoring, maybe there's three different pieces to it. And the first is during that remedy, when you applied that remedy, at the end of the day, did it work? And this is before and after stuff. And so, you know, I've got maybe wells in that source zone. I'm looking at groundwater concentrations. What was the concentration before? What's the concentration after? How many ohms reduction did I get? And did I meet my objectives that are in this smart one that we set out before we started on this thing? Process monitoring, we turned it on. Is it working correctly? And maybe some of that data is looking at redox conditions. If I'm trying to turn the whole thing really deeply anaerobic, maybe I've got tracers in there that I'm trying to study. And then maybe I'm looking at the flow rates if I'm doing a pump and treat system. And then finally, there's compliance monitoring, and that's this well that, you know, that's what you regulators out there on the training today, you know, that's what you guys are real focused on. You know, how are we comparing regulatory limits? Is everybody safe? You know, is this plume entered this zone that I'm really trying to watch here, my point of compliance well? Has the concentrations pulled back so now this is clean? So here's different media to monitor, and again, one of our complications is there's a lot of different stuff out there. You know, we talk a lot about DNAPL, then excuse me, ache for Matrix solids are a key piece of this. Soil gas, we talked about that being one of those key drivers that's in there. You know, I think there was one comment about, you know, potentially new concern about the short-term exposure to TCEs to pregnant women. And so that's one of these things that are starting to show up at more of these sites. Of course, then we have our big ones, the groundwater. We're looking just going to go in there and see what that concentration is, and then the more surface water, and this may become more important, particularly for compounds like PFAS that are out there, these per- and polyfluorinated compounds that are showing up at becoming more of a area of attention for our field. Okay, what are some of the metrics here? Concentration, you know, we got milligram per liter for groundwater, milligram per kilogram for soil, ppmv for vapor, mass of contaminants. Let's do the kilograms, or if you're sort of a simple person from Texas, you know, it's pounds of contaminant. And then finally, mass flux, mass discharge. The document was very specific. We have our own guidance about how to think about this. Mass flux is that's units of meter square, grams per meter squared per day, sort of this amount flowing through this. And then if I just draw this vertical line in the sand, mass discharge is how many grams per day are going across that line and flowing down gradient in here. So these different metrics are in here in terms of thinking about the data valuation. Just some more about sort of thinking about how do you process the data. We're doing a lot more of this stuff of maintaining, improving conceptual models and visualization tools can help. There have been some great presentations. Tamsin has got a great presentation about some of the visualization tools she's used at some of her sites, but they can really sort of help you understand this. And there's some developments in there. Some of the Arcadis people, the late Suthan Sutherson, talked about having an iPad that's sort of connected to your virtual conceptual model, and you walk around the site, and you can see, oh, I'm right over the MW44 hotspot, you know, or something like that. So there's some neat things thinking about visualization. But then you also go back to the stats, and the stats can really help you understand trends and really sort of help you go through this data, because our data has all this noise in it, sort of bouncing up and down. How do you process that, and how do you sort of get through that? Stats can help you do some of that. And I think the next slide sort of helps a little bit with some of this and sort of goes through thinking about trends and you know, you're trying to answer the question, are you remediated or not remediated? What are the interpretations? There are a lot of decisions in there. We do have a decision framework that sort of ties into this first key question. You know, is the groundwater plume or source being actively treated? So there's one way, it's more for M&A or natural source zone depletion, and you go down and look at some of this stuff, and then contaminant trend may mean something different if you're doing some remediation, but there's a flowchart in there. But we talk about some of these free tools in there. This MARO system, something that I helped co-write, it's a free download developed by the Air Forces and an access database. But you can also, for some stats, there's one commonly used tool that we use a lot. It's called the Mann-Kendall method. And I talked about it when you've got some stats, you're trying to identify the trend, or is my concentrations increasing or decreasing or stable? Ask the Mann. And so there's a free tool, again, on this webpage right here. You can go in and download the Mann-Kendall toolkit and do some of this. Also, some great tools from Summit Monitoring Tools. GTS has got a really good algorithm that's got more high-powered statistics into it that's very useful. And so we talk about all these sort of things in there. Next slide, we talk about something that I'm real interested in, and it's sort of this idea of modeling performance monitoring. And you might think about, why do you use these computer models, these groundwater models? Well, in some ways, just develop a glide path. And if you do some treatments, you want to see, am I on that glide path? Is it really happening for me or not? So there are different flavors of these guys. There are source zone models that really show you the source of impact of remediation or M&A on a source. And I'll give you some examples of that. Fate and transport models, these are ones that are really about the plume. And you can put in changing source things in there, but it's sort of you have to manually enter how that source changes. So some examples of this one right here, RemChlor, and then the new one, RemFuel, which is at fuel sites, does this. You can go there and reach into the heart of the dragon and pull out some of that mass. I can pull out 90% of the mass. What does that do to my plume over time? So that's a good example of this. Fate and transport models are some simple ones that I did, BioScreen and BioChlor, and with these particular different models that are in there. Just note about BioScreen, it's the most sort of an older one, 1996. It models a natural attenuation of a fuel plume, and really it doesn't always do any remediation at its source, but you can see this thing change over time. And one of the reasons, of course, it's one of the most highly downloadable models is every Monday I call up my mom and have her download, 10 or 20 just to get my stats up. But that's an example of a fate and transport model. Modflow MT3D is another example of this, a more sophisticated one that you can put in some of this heterogeneity and see some of these things. And finally, there's the NAS Natural Attenuation Software tool done by Mark Wittison and then Frank Chappelle. Really a neat tool thinking about natural attenuation, again, doesn't allow you to think about the remediation piece, but then sort of see how does that plume transition, how does it change over time, establish, and give me that glide path. Let's look at REMCOR a little bit in more detail, again, done by Dr. Ron Fault at Clemson, and here's some slides from this that we did some training, and that is you can set this thing up, and here's the source, and it sort of went out here and established this plume, and here's concentration of the contaminant in log scale, okay, on these three different graphs, and this is time, 1967 to 2027. So you see these big time scales in there, and this is what the model showed. So this is the source. It quickly gets up this concentration. There's Dean Apple there. So it slowly decays. Then they did this remediation, and bam, they got one order of magnitude in this model, and you can start seeing the impact of this here. Now, this one is right down gradient of a zero-valent iron wall. It looks like they're getting about one, maybe two orders of magnitude in the red dots. But this says that, yeah, you're really going to start to see this. And then downgrade it, not much of an effect yet, but the idea that the model, you will start seeing it soon. Now, a quick note is that REMCOR sort of handles matrix diffusion in the source, but it doesn't handle matrix diffusion in the plume. However, there's a new version coming out this year. Our shop's helping to write the interface for it, REMCOR MD. That's going to be really amazing, and you can really see, I do all this work in the plume, in the source. Does it affect me in my plume 300 meters down gradient? So just sort of wrapping up a couple more of these slides, just in terms of optimizing, monitoring, there's a work on this Morrow system, GTS are designed to do that. Do I really need MW1 and MW2 within 10 feet of each other and monitor those for the next 50 years? No, let's get rid of that MW2 and just stick with MW1. Are there any data gaps? That area by the North 40 is sort of a big question mark to us. Yeah, we knew that. So these computer tools can help you sort of see where you're got too many wells and where you don't have enough. Then there's this whole question about frequency and duration, and there's a lot of work done in saying, do we really want to sample quarterly? And I think our field's really doing well with this because I think that quarterly sampling is becoming less prevalent. And there's this idea that many sites, semi-annual, twice a year, or just once a year sort of gives you this picture. There's an ESTCP tool by my colleague Tom McHugh, talks about the sort of time versus money and sort of talks about what do you get from frequent sampling, how long does it take you to sort of understand your trend. That's sort of an interesting tool, the software tool that you can use. Contaminant constituents, can I sort of get my contaminant numbers down and just instead of the whole list, just do one or two to do some of that. And I think the last slide that's sort of in my section is something that my friend Brian Looney at the Savannah River National Lab talked about. And he says you have all these different tools, and there's different examples of this, but you're trying to start out with this field data, lab data, and literature, and your experience, and maybe documents like the IDSS documents, and use screening tools in here to think about different things. There's a document called Scenarios that helps you understand conceptual models for metal sites and for chlorinated solvent sites. You think about remedial operations. Then there's sort of hand calculations plus these spreadsheet tools that are in here. There's one called Source Decay. That's a source decay type software, mass flux toolkit. Think about source mass, geometry, and discharge. And these stats tools in here, Morrow's GTS, really help you think about trends. And you sort of mix and match these and get this technically based, information that's in there. So I think with that, it's about time for me to wrap up, and I'm going to hand it off to Dr. Tamsin McBeth, CDM Smith, and she's going to talk about remedy evaluation. And Tamsin, take it away.
Thanks, Chuck.
So at this stage in the training, we are really looking at the remedy as a whole. We've gone through, developed the remedy, implemented some technologies, done some monitoring, and really are at the point of, are we meeting our objectives, and what can we do if we're not? Does this process, or how can this process be applied to sites where things perhaps aren't going the way that we anticipated or that we expected? And the reality is, the majority of sites that have been undergoing these remedial programs, especially for chlorinated solvent sites, it's actually this stage of the process that projects are often in, and that's that they've implemented some remedies, things haven't worked as well as they had anticipated. So what can be done? How do you really evaluate or reevaluate these sites that aren't meeting objectives, and how can you course correct, if you will, so that you can get your remedy on a path that is making progress towards meeting those objectives? Or how do you really just optimize and revise that strategy? And so this is the key element of this section of the training, is really, how do you do that? So first, there are some key questions. You know, we talked a lot earlier in the training about objectives and how to set objectives. And we talk about this functional objectives. And so the first question really is, are you meeting those functional objectives? Are you making progress towards those objectives? And then the second is, you know, can you be more efficient? So there is an element of this overall strategy that deals with optimization. There are strategic time points, or at strategic time points, you should be asking yourself the question of whether you're doing things as efficiently or as effectively as you could be, you know, implementing like best management practices to ensure that your remedy is as efficient and optimized, and then really, how do you troubleshoot if you're not? So the first question, are your objectives being met? And this is really a periodic evaluation. And one of the things the project team talked a lot about is, you know, how can you build a monitoring program that provides information in time to make strategic decisions about course correcting if you need to? So you have to think about that, the timing for things like process monitoring, you know, implementing thermal and collecting data that will allow you to adjust that technology, versus evaluating compliance or defining a stable or retracting plume for a monitor natural attenuation remedy are different. And so you have to sort of adjust that timing in terms of how frequently you need that data to evaluate that endpoint. The other key thing to recognize, especially for chlorinated solvent sites, is that you have to plan for contingencies, and you have to plan for this sort of adaptive strategies. These sites are complex, and we often only have part of the picture, and we're trying to make decisions and implement technologies with only partial information, and we are continually learning new things about our sites. And so it's really critical to understand that you may have to make adjustments and that things may not work out the way that you anticipate, and to build that into your overall strategy and to really identify the changes that you can make as you learn new information. So one site, a CERCLA type of site, has this 5-year review, and that is built into that regulatory program specifically so that the project team can really look at a high level about the progress or the implementation of that CERCLA remedy and make changes. Now, of course, if you've met all your functional objectives, the idea then is that you can start implementing your closure strategy. But if you haven't, then this is where the second question is, if you haven't met all those functional objectives, are you making sufficient progress towards those? And this really gets into this remedy optimization and looking at
this sort of long-term management strategy to decide, can I do things better? And we recognize that the management of coordinated solvent sites is going to be or occur over the course of years or potentially decades, right? And a lot can happen within that time frame. There's changes in environmental laws. Our technologies improve, both our remediation technologies, our monitoring technologies. There's lots of research and development going on right now about new tools that you can implement that will provide better information about things like monitor natural attenuation or degradation reactions, abiotic degradation reactions, and so really incorporating all of our improved understanding about all these aspects of our remedy can really help make the remedies more efficient and effective. And of course, why do we want to optimize? The long and the short is that we all want to save time and money. You know, there's lots of efficiencies of scale, there's efficiencies in technologies and remediation, and so we really want to take advantage of that, as well as efficiencies in technologies. So if you have sort of an optimized remedy, or you've implemented a remedy, or you've determined that, well, optimization probably isn't going to help, then the question really is, how can you troubleshoot if your functional objectives are not being met at an acceptable rate, and there's really not an optimization that can be done that will help that. And our team talked a lot about this, and what tends to happen is you implement a technology, you don't achieve your objective, so then you kind of go back to your technology toolbox and pull out another technology and apply that technology, and this gets into this sort of iterative loop of applying technology after technology after technology and still not achieving your objectives and saying, oh, that technology failed, oh, that technology failed, and really kind of blaming, if you will, the technologies, when the reality is when our team talked about why do remedies fail, why don't we meet our objectives, more often than not, the reason is the conceptual site model. And that the conceptual site model that was used in that decision making, that was used, you know, to implement those technologies was wrong. And so really what we advocate is go all the way back up to the top of this strategy and look at your conceptual site model and make sure that it really incorporates all of the available information about a site, and that it also incorporates this new understanding. Ryan talked a lot about things like matrix diffusion and sorption and complexity and hydrology and heterogeneity, and how all of that can really impact both how contaminants are distributed in the subsurface, how they migrate in the subsurface, and sort of their long-term performance. So we really have to recognize that there's often a lot of uncertainties in the conceptual site models. And one of the things that can be helpful that our team recognized is this EPA 2008 document, which sort of has this checklist about what a conceptual site model should include. And one of the things that we did is really go through on slide 74 and talk about revisiting the conceptual site model and talk about common inaccuracies in conceptual site models and why these models often fail. One of the biggest things is we often are thinking about our plumes in two dimensions when the reality is a lot of that heterogeneity and the complexity is in three dimensions. So make sure that you understand the vertical component of your subsurface system. What are your different geologic stratigraphic layers? What's the heterogeneity? Where's the contaminant mass stored within your low permeability versus your high permeability zones? What are your boundary conditions? What are your hydraulics? You know, one of the things I often see in reviewing these older sites is, you know, there was one round of groundwater hydraulic gradients collected 20 years ago, and that's been used in, you know, every fate and transport or mass transport calculation subsequent. And there's a lot of impacts like seasonal variability in gradients, especially if you have surface water impacting, infiltration impacting. You know, it's not uncommon at sites, say, close to a surface water source, a river, a stream, for that can be gaining or losing seasonally, for us to see up to, say, 180 degrees C and shift in groundwater gradients. So really just understanding, or preferential flow paths. We work a lot in glacial till, and the subsurface channels or channeling can have a really big impact on where plumes go compared to what, say, a regional groundwater gradient might convey. And I have a site right now in Oregon where the regional gradient indicates groundwater flow is going west, but because of low permeability till layers and preferential sand and gravel channels, the groundwater plumes are actually migrating more north, northwest. So these kinds of complexities can really affect how contaminant distribution is occurring and how those contaminants are migrating. And if you're trying to make decisions about laying in, say, grout in-situ treatment technologies, understanding those complexities is really important. So go back to your conceptual site model. Look at these things that may be affecting that conceptual site model first. Once you feel that your conceptual site model is robust, the next thing is to really go back and revisit those objectives. And Alex talked a lot about objectives, and one of the things the team recognized is that often the objectives that we set are really not in line with, or not aligned with, how technologies are implemented, or there's a lot of unrealistic expectations of technology performance. And Chuck's discussion about OOMs, you know, we want to get 5 orders of magnitude reduction in concentration, but we're applying technologies that typically can only get 1. So really we need to sort of align the objectives and make sure that if the overarching goal is to get 5 orders of magnitude, that we have a lot of steps built in interim objectives, these interim functional objectives that define these realistic steps or processes that can be put in place to get us that 5 OOMs, recognizing that it's going to be a 5-step process and not a 1-step process. The other is really just understanding where you're collecting data relative to where you're implementing, say, some treatment. You know, I often will see remedies implemented where we're monitoring, say, distal or down gradient concentrations in a plume, and we're using that to assess performance of a source technology, because we have a conceptual site model, like Ryan said, where you cut off the head of the snake in that source treatment and you expect to see some concentration reduction at those down gradient extents. But if it's matrix diffusion or desorption that's really feeding the concentrations at that distal plume well, then that objective of seeing that concentration reduction at that distal well is really not in line with the source treatment. So again, reiterate, think about these SMART objectives. It's really important from the perspective of making sure that our objectives are supporting our remedy, you know, and that we have sufficient rigor and realistic expectations of those objectives so that we can support that remedy and the remedy implementation. So now, when we are going back through this, revisiting all of the elements of our remedy, we have a robust conceptual site model. We've built in some realistic objectives, or objectives that we think are realistic now. Now it's really time to, okay, now let's look at technologies and really start to understand technology performance and evaluation. And this is where you have expected technology performance and actual, and recognizing that often technologies, you know, they perform on a spectra, meaning depending on your site characteristics, technologies and technology performance, you know, varies as a function of that. And so it really is, again, looking at what's the range of expected performance. Is it the 50% or the two orders of magnitude, you know, that range of performance that Chuck showed for some of these different technologies? Where do we think that technology is going to apply or perform for my specific site, and evaluating that? And really deciding, you know, is the technology that I'm applying, or the suite of technologies that I'm applying, has it outlived its usefulness? And this comes into play a lot for these long-term technologies like pump and treat. You know, we often will come and evaluate pump and treat systems that have been operating for 20, 30, 40 years, you know, whose original goals was, you know, mass removal or a stability of the plume, and those technologies have reached what we call sort of a point of diminishing returns, where they're really not achieving the same kind of mass removal or efficiency in mass removal that perhaps they did when they started up. And so really, how can you evaluate the performance of those technologies, and specifically what's the steps or the iteration of steps to take to shut those systems down, or when can you shut those systems down? So talking about technology decisions, and really there's three basic decisions that can be made with technologies. Either you continue to operate the technology, you optimize that technology, or you cease operations, or perhaps you transition to another approach. So those are kind of our key technology decisions. And so one of the things that the team did is we developed a conceptual example to really highlight these decision processes and how you might think about these key technology decisions when you're implementing a remedy. And in this conceptual example here, we have a site where we're implementing a source treatment technology, and the source treatment objective is to decrease the contaminant mass discharge from that source by 99% in 5 years. So we want to get this two orders of magnitude reduction. We want to do it in a relatively short period of time. We built our conceptual site model, and based on that conceptual site model, determined that if we implement an aggressive source treatment, say an in-situ thermal remediation for that source, we expect a reduction in mass discharge by 90% in 5 months. So very aggressive technology, you know, kind of hit it on the head with a hammer. And then based on evaluating the plume attenuation capacity and plume attenuation, we expect that by natural attenuation, that additional 9% reduction in contaminant mass discharge is achievable in the next 4.5 years. So we'll try to get the first order of magnitude quickly, and then expect attenuation to take care of the rest in the next 4.5 years. So we build this strategy, develop the interim objectives for these two technologies, and then implement the technology, the source treatment, and during the implementation, look at the short-term performance of that aggressive technology and realize, well, at the end of the 4 months, we've actually only achieved a 60% reduction in the contaminant mass discharge instead of the 90%. And so this is sort of one of the key decision points that needs to be made. Should we continue this aggressive and really expensive treatment? What is the impact towards achieving that overarching objective and getting that 99% reduction in mass discharge? And how can we sort of make this key decision? So what are our options? Well, first, to go back and really revisit the overarching objective, that 99% reduction in contaminant mass discharge, And looking at if we only get the 60% reduction, how does that impact that overarching objective? So we go back through, assume the same sort of attenuation capacity here. This is the red is the actual performance. And recognize that, well, it's going to take probably another couple of years of attenuation if we only get 60% initially before we reach that 99% reduction. So the first question is that okay? You know, in the long-term strategy, is there land use issues, why you really wanted it turned over in 5 years? If it's okay, then go ahead, shut the system down, you know, wait another couple of years. If the answer is no, we really want to achieve the full reduction that we wanted within the 5 years, that's critical to the project, then we need to look at what our options are, and it's either, well, continue to operate that aggressive treatment technology and troubleshoot that technology, try to figure out why is it not working as well as we thought, or potentially transition that really aggressive technology perhaps to another technology that's moderately more aggressive than, say, M&A or attenuation, but might augment to accelerate the treatment process during that attenuation period. So it may be shut the aggressive thermal down. That's perhaps as much as efficient as we think we can be with that technology, but hey, let's maybe implement something like an in-situ bio that will help really kind of accelerate mass removal and treatment during that attenuation period. So that just sort of gives you some an example of how you might think about the technologies, how you might think about adjusting things based on technology performance, and, you know, make key decisions about technologies during the implementation of your remedy or your program. So just an overall summary here. One of the key elements, again, in this re-evaluation or remedy evaluation is that this conceptual site model is a living document. It will be and should be updated throughout the entire implementation of the remedy. That objectives, especially functional objectives, are not static. They're not permanent. They are should be as fluid and as adaptive as your strategy, recognizing that these sites are complex and that you may need to go back and revisit these objectives. And also ensuring that they're smart and they're really sort of supporting the framework and the decisions that you're trying to make for the remedy. Planning transitions to technologies, the example that I showed, recognizing often even our most robust technologies do not perform as we expect. And are we thinking about, well, what happens if things don't work out the way we expect? Do we have contingencies? What are kind of our critical decision points where, you know, we have to implement things so that the overarching outcome is what we want? And are we planning for those transitions? Are we developing realistic interim goals and contingencies? And really recognizing this is going to be a continual sort of performance evaluation over multiple or many years, potentially over multiple cycles or implementations of different remediation technologies, and we just need to make sure that our performance monitoring is really optimized continuously, kind of like the conceptual site model. You know, as you're updating your conceptual site model, you need to be updating that monitoring program to make sure that it's providing the information you need when you need it, but it's also that it's efficient. You know, collecting 20 years of quarterly data for a M&A strategy is, you know, a lot of times sort of a waste of time and money. So make sure, you know, that system is really serving the project. And really reevaluating your strategy. That is the integrated DNAPL site strategy, is understanding you need adaptability, you need contingency, and you need reevaluation, and you're going to likely need to reevaluate. And so with that, I'm actually going to turn it back over to Aaron Cohen for our wrap-up.
Thanks, Tamsin. We should all be on slide number 82. This slide summarizes the primary problems that are usually encountered at chlorinated solvent sites, which result in the expenditure of time and money with little or no improvement. The solution to these problems can be found in a set of ITRC guidance documents. The first is the ITRC DNAPL Site Strategy, or IDSS, document, which we've been talking about today. The second is the Integrated DNAPL Site Characterization and Tool Selection Guidance and Training. And the third is the Use and Measurement of Mass Flux and Mass Discharge Guidance and Training. I'll touch briefly on these in a second. So let's move on to slide 83. This slide is a course summary of sorts. What we want you to take away from this course is that you can use this document to develop a strategy for your site. You know, you can enter the strategy or, you know, or this flowchart at any point depending upon where you are in your site in its life cycle. You might not need to utilize every chapter, you know, but the most effective site strategies generally will, because if your site is languishing in some way, the odds are there's at least one facet of the site that's covered in this document which you don't have an adequate understanding of. Moving on to slide 84. As I mentioned, today's training is a companion piece with two other ITRC guidance and training documents. The first is the Integrated DNAPL Site Characterization and Tools Selection Guidance. This document focuses on site characterization with an emphasis on high-resolution characterization and the tools used to obtain high-resolution characterization data. It can assist practitioners with developing more accurate conceptual site models, reducing uncertainty at sites, and yielding better performing remedies. On the slide 85, this is the second companion piece, and it's the Use and Measurement of Mass Flux and Mass Discharge. This document and its associated training will allow the practitioner to more effectively estimate subsurface mass and mass flux. This understanding improves site management by allowing for remedy refinement, exposure assessment refinement, and monitoring well network optimization. And this generally can result in enhanced compliance. So I would encourage all of the listeners to download copies of these documents and to attend the online training the next time it's offered. And with that, I will turn it back over to Juliana.
Thanks, Aaron. We are going to have time for questions. So from our audience, you are welcome to send in questions using that Q&A in the lower right. If you're on the phone line, #6 to unmute, and feel free to jump in with questions. Before we get to those, I do want to tell you about our links to additional resources and our feedback form. So you can follow either of these links here on the slide. In our additional resources, we do have more information about many of the links that we've talked about during today's training class, and that page is going to be continue to be available as a resource for you. So you're welcome to bookmark that and go back to that for more information. We do look for everyone on the call to fill out the feedback form. If you have more than one person at your location, one person can fill out the form, and then there's a link once you submit it to go back and allow another person to fill out the feedback form. We really do use the information that you provide. We mentioned that Fractured Rock team that's going on now with ITRC. We're getting ready to start the training development for that team. So your feedback is something that we read and we use as we develop this new training. And we also use the information to help improve today's training class as we plan to offer it again, this class again in the fall. This is also, the feedback is also your opportunity to get a certificate for attending today's class. And right now it's the only way to do that. So fill out the feedback form, check the box at the bottom to confirm that you attended, and then submit. Once you submit, the system's going to generate that certificate for you. So if you forget to check the box, just go back, check the box, submit again, because the only way to get the certificate is by completing the feedback form and checking the box at the bottom. We'll now get to as many questions as we can. So in the bottom right is the Q&A, and I also have a couple poll questions that I'm going to pull up for you to answer as we're finishing up today's class. So you can send in questions in the bottom right. And then along the bottom of the slides, we do have a couple of polls. Would you recommend using the Integrated DNAPL Site Strategy described today? And thinking about projects that you're working on in the next 6 months, how could you use this ITRC guidance? So getting to some of the questions that have come in, On slide 51, a study was mentioned that shows bio is effective after ISCO. Can the study reference be provided?
This is Chuck, and I'm just looking at our document, looking at the table itself, and I'm just going through here, and this is this table 4.2, table compatibility matrix. It says that bioremediation can follow in situ oxidation. It's generally compatible but requires consideration of the chemical reagents. Then it says, see here, note 4, and I sort of remember this, is that there was papers by Bryant and Haybert, 2008, and so there's a whole paragraph about this. It looks like that's the only reference. So I think it was, I don't know if there was actually a key reference that sort of led us down that road. There were just people's experience that said it. But just a quick scan, I think I just see a reference to Bryant and Haybert, 2008, but I don't remember the paper itself. So I think that's all I know right now. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. We do have time for more questions. It looks like the trainers have answered several of the questions online. So you're welcome to send in a question using that Q&A pod in the lower right. Looking at our poll results, would you recommend using this integrated DNAPL site strategy described today? And so far, we have yes from everyone. So that's 46 answers so far. So you are welcome to 47. You're welcome to fill out that poll. And then thinking about projects that you're working on in the next 6 months, how could you use this ITRC guidance? And we are broadcasting these results, so you get to see the answers that are coming in from other participants on the training class today. So some people are going to use the guidance. They're going to help educate their clients and provide a structure for completing these activities. So you can scroll down to see the wide variety of answers that have come in so far responding to this poll question. I do want to give it a little bit more time just to be sure that we're answering all of the questions that people have. I don't want to wrap up too early. We have about 9 more minutes scheduled for today's class so we could answer more questions if they came in. So questions come in. Given that most technologies can only get 1 to 2 contaminant reduction, yet we generally have to get 4 or more to reach MCLs. Is remediation to MCLs even feasible?
Well, this is Chuck. I'll take a quick first stab at that. Is the document goes into that, and we just say that it's rare that these sort of one-shot projects, you know, one application of technologies gets to MCLs, and that we really have to think about these sites in a longer context, that we're going to, you know, potentially do this active remediation and then get to this point where maybe of diminishing returns and then switch to either M&A to handle the rest or maybe larger, more complex sites and go to active remediation. And so that's sort of this general one road to go out there. So the question is do you get much benefit about spending money to get that 1 to 2 reduction when you have to get 4? And that's sort of a question for the stakeholders. It's sort of a difficult one to analyze. It removing 90% of the mass, that's good, but then you don't get all the way there. So a lot of work's being sort of trying to evaluate that stuff. But that's a key question for our industry, and not one with a, you know, really clear yes or no answer.
Thank you. A reminder for our audience, we do use your feedback and would appreciate you taking just a few minutes now at the end of the training class to complete that feedback form. It is your opportunity to help not only improve today's class, but also improve future classes that you may be interested in. The feedback form is also your option for creating a certificate. So if you are interested in a certificate for today's class, be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify that you attended. We don't have any more questions, so we'll go ahead and wrap up today's training class. If you do have a question that we haven't been able to get to or we didn't completely answer some of your questions, you're welcome to email us at training@itrcweb.org with your question, and we will note that for the trainers to follow up. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us today. More information about ITRC is available on the website, www.itrc.org.